this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, LexisNexis may grow on NCSU campus. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. And the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. On the far left, there's a picture of two people walking in a building. The caption reads, then-Governor Beverly Perdue and LexisNexis Michael Lipps touring the Cary facility in 2012. Executives with LexisNexis Group, a legal research firm, are in discussions with Red Hat leaders about relocating their Triangle operations from Cary to NC State University Centennial Campus to accommodate a growing workforce. Dayton, Ohio-based LexisNexis announced plans in early 2012 to add 350 employees to its Cary Operations Center by 2017, but the company was never going to have enough room to grow that large at its current Regency Park office building. Discussions with various office landlords around the Triangle were ongoing throughout 2012 and continue, but real estate sources say the company started narrowing its focus on a Red Hat building at Centennial Campus in late 2012. Red Hat has been seeking a sublease tenant for its 120,000-square-foot headquarters building at 1801 Varsity Drive as the company transitions its employees into the larger Red Hat Tower building in downtown Raleigh. Red Hat expects to complete its move by the end of 2013, bringing with it about 900 workers to downtown Raleigh. Red Hat already has leased out some of its Centennial Campus space. The open-source software company in June signed a contract in which Bandwidth.com took 75,000 square feet of space in the Venture 3 building. Bandwidth signed a 4-year sublease and relocated its operations into the Venture building in the fall. Neither a spokeswoman for Red Hat nor a spokesman for LexisNexis was available to comment about a potential second sublease deal at Centennial Campus. But Cary Economic Development Director Sandy Jordan says it was evident early on in the process of LexisNexis's expansion that it would need to move to a bigger building. I hate to see them move from Cary, but it is good for the area that they are expanding, Jordan says. I do remember getting the sense that sooner or later they would need more space. As of January 9, LexisNexis had 17 job openings listed on its website for the Cary office, including multiple listings for senior software engineers. At the ribbon-cutting ceremony for the expansion of the company's Cary office in late March, Michael Lipps, Vice President and General Manager of Legal Business Software Solutions for LexisNexis, said the average salary for the jobs it was planning to add in Cary was around $90,000 a year, or almost double the Wake County average. The company at the time of the announcement employed about 140 people in Cary, and it expects to grow to nearly 500 employees within the next 4 years. LexisNexis also employs about 150 people in Charlotte. The North Carolina Department of Commerce has promised the company a job development investment grant valued at nearly $9 million if the company meets all of its job creation and investment targets. Jordan says the town did not offer LexisNexis a local incentive package. LexisNexis supplies software and data services for legal, tax, regulatory, insurance, and business clients around the world. And our next article is in the center of the front page, has a black border around it. Within that, the background is olive color. At the top, there are two pictures, a large picture taking up the top half of the space, and then a smaller picture inset, and they're showing empty shots of a building, empty inside and then a deserted-looking outside of a building. And the caption reads, agents are looking for sublease tenants for Nortel's space. And then under that in bold black and red lettering is the headline, remains of a giant, Nortel fell hard and only 20 workers are still here. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Research Triangle Park. Where some 2,000 Nortel Networks employees once bustled about doing the work of a Red Hat company in the landline telecom industry before cell phones burst onto the market, bright yellow and blue hallways now are quiet. A cafeteria went dark in December when the vendor stopped serving lunch because there were not enough people eating. All of the fitness equipment in the workout room was removed years ago because what's left of Nortel didn't want the liability. The Canadian company still has a shell staff of about 20 people working at its Research Triangle Park campus, helping to finalize any loose ends from a bankruptcy court plan that resulted in the sale of most of Nortel's once considerable assets in 2009 and 2010. Those 20 people and the few data center machines are about all that is left of Nortel in the United States. The telecommunications company at its height employed 94,000 people globally, some 9,000 of them in RTP. We've been told that it could go on for another couple of years until everything's wrapped up, says Alan Lane, customer business manager for Johnson Controls, a facilities management firm hired to oversee maintenance of the campus. Lane worked for Nortel for 35 years prior to joining Johnson Controls. Collectively, Nortel and the businesses that have purchased pieces of its operations out of a bankruptcy collectively employ an estimated 520 people at what was known as the Gateway Campus. But that might even be stretching it a bit based on the number of cars in the parking lots on a recent workday. Nortel has changed the signs around the 105-acre campus near the intersection of Davis Drive and NC 54 to reflect a new name, Park Point, in an effort to attract tenants to rent the office, warehouse, and laboratory space it still has here. It has hired the CBRE commercial real estate firm to market the buildings to prospective tenants. Nortel has already vacated the newer Network Center campus buildings across the street. Network Center is now owned and occupied by Fidelity Investments. Avaya, Genban, and Ericsson collectively lease less than half of the 750,000 square feet of space that was built out in the 1980s at Park Point to house the workers and equipment they inherited from Nortel's former telecommunications business. That is why Lane hopes they can find another corporate tenant or tenants to fill up the remaining space. At least all that space is not affecting the market vacancy rate for now, because all of the buildings will technically be fully occupied through July 2016 under a master lease agreement with Nortel. Andrew Kelton, director of the Asset Services Group for the CBRE office in Raleigh, says his goal is to find more cash savings for what's left of Nortel's creditors and to minimize the company's exposure to additional costs. Kelton has teamed with CBRE real estate veteran Ed Pulliam to market the buildings. There's plenty of room for expansion out there, Kelton says, noting that the Park Point campus even has its own electric power substation operated by Duke Energy. Lane says Duke is currently in negotiations to buy the substation so it can add capacity for other customers in the area. Kelton and Pulliam were also the brokers who helped negotiate the sale of the Network Center campus to Fidelity Investments in 2011 for $34.3 million. Fidelity is in the process of renovating the Network Center buildings and constructing a new parking deck for its Triangle area staff, as well as several other projects that the company isn't ready to talk about yet. Construction is proceeding and going well, Fidelity spokeswoman Jenny Engel says. Nortel's master lease with the property owner, Zurich Structured Finance, runs through mid-2016, but Kelton says that any tenant leasing space on the campus will have an option to extend a lease term beyond 2016. Plus, there is a potential to sell the whole building, he says. And our last front page article runs vertically along the right side of the page. The headline, UNC Chapel Hill leads in number of deficient profs. This article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Chapel Hill. And underneath the article, there's a picture of a man in suit and tie. The caption reads, Holden Thorpe is Chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill. A faculty review of tenured professors at UNC Chapel Hill found 13 of them to be deficient last year, the highest among all UNC system institutions and the most at Chapel Hill in at least a decade. A similar review at NC State University found 7 faculty deficient in the 2011 to 2012 school year. To be sure, those universities account for a large portion of the University of Carolina system faculty, which skews their totals higher. But in percentage terms, 5% of faculty reviewed at UNC Chapel Hill and 4.6% of faculty at NCSU were found deficient. For all other campuses combined, 4% of faculty were found deficient. Taken as a whole, the UNC system reviewed 779 tenured faculty members and found 35 deficient, or 4.5% of those reviewed. That's the highest percentage in the past decade and above the 2.8% average for the past 10 years. At NC Central University, one faculty member was found deficient in 2011 to 2012. NCCU has had 13 deficient faculty in the past decade. The peer review process was put in place in 1997, quote, to support and encourage excellence among tenured faculty, unquote, according to the system's policy manual. In the most serious cases, failure to improve after a negative review could lead to a recommendation for discharge. Betsy Brown, NCSU Vice Provost for Faculty Affairs, says the policies grew out of a misunderstanding by certain tenured faculty who essentially thought that tenure gave them a sort of immunity and they would not be looked at anymore. She says adding a peer review to the process was very important. After a negative review, some faculty decide to simply retire. This happened four times across the system after reviews in both the 2008 to 2009 and 2009 to 2010 school years. It happened twice after the 2010 to 2011 review, with one retiring from UNC Chapel Hill and one retiring from NCSU. Names were not released in the report. A peer group evaluates faculty on a five-year rotating basis at each campus, and a full report is compiled for the UNC System Board of Governors. Representatives of UNC Chapel Hill were not made available to discuss the numbers. Mike McFarland, the university's director of communications, only confirmed the numbers were accurate and that none of the deficient faculty were from the African and Afro-American Studies Department, a department that came under scrutiny during an NCAA investigation into how athletes were treated and in which university chancellor Holden Thorpe admitted to academic misconduct. The annual faculty review is separate from any NCAA investigation. Faculty can review one of four can receive one of four designations after a review. At UNC Chapel Hill, 113 faculty, or 44%, were found to be superior, and 54 were found to be above average. The remaining 77 reviewed were found to be satisfactory. Looking at the decade as a whole, NCSU has the highest total deficient faculty with 67 such designations. By comparison, UNC Chapel Hill has 42 such faculty over the decade. Brown offered more faculty at her university, are found deficient because the reviewers take the process more seriously than at other universities. This can be a rubber stamp, as is, and is in many places, she says. Of the remaining 144 NCSU faculty members reviewed that were not found deficient, all 144 were designated satisfactory. Brown says faculty at NCSU see the review as an opportunity to make departments better, not single out specific faculty. Once a faculty member is found deficient at NCSU, that member meets with department leaders to establish a plan for development. That plan probably would include measurable milestones and a timeline within which to accomplish those goals. People have a pretty good opportunity to improve their performance, Brown says. She says review by other faculty is constructive because professors are likely to respond better to criticism from their peers. Each university has its own set of policies, but they are roughly the same and are largely what one would expect from such a review process. They include reviews of published works, research grants and projects, and time spent teaching, among other aspects. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, New York firm scouts area for financial ops. A New York financial services company has scanned the Triangle and other cities for talent and office space as it looks for ways to save on expenses. IPREO, spelled I-P-R-E-O, a capital markets data research firm, has also looked in the Charlotte region and Atlanta as it searches for what the company calls cost-effective alternative sourcing platforms. The search is reported to be looking for enough space to hold at least 120 employees, sources say. Kate McKay, Managing Director of Global Marketing and Communications, says the 600-employee, quickly growing company has an ongoing commitment to hiring high-caliber talent. However, McKay declined to answer questions about whether IPRIO is looking for a new headquarters or a smaller facility that would function as a branch of the New York headquarters. The Carolinas and other locations are being considered for such a platform, McKay says. However, it is important to emphasize that management has not finalized its decision to execute this program or where to implement it. Sources say IPRIO has been searching the southeast for at least 50,000 square feet. Commercial real estate sources in the Triangle say they met with representatives of a New York-based company in October and November that matched the description of IPRIO. Duke University's law school is considered among the best dozen or so in the nation, but that hasn't deterred two of its graduates from building something of a practice on lawsuits against the university. The two Durham attorneys, Bob Extrand and Samantha Extrand of Extrand & Extrand, represented three student-athletes who sued the school over fallout from the infamous 2006 lacrosse scandal. Most recently, the firm represented a female student who alleged that a hostile environment led to her being raped at a fraternity party. That lawsuit was dismissed in December, according to a report in North Carolina Lawyers Weekly. Bob Extrand represented Andrew Giuliani, son of the former New York mayor, when he was kicked off the school's golf team and sued for breach of contract in 2008. In recommending that the suit be thrown out, federal magistrate judge Wallace A. Dixon dropped phrases like mulligan, shanks this claim, in the drink, and swing and a miss. Dixon summarily dismissed one claim with a quote from Bill Murray's character in Caddyshack. He's on his final hole. He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think. The pharmaceutical industry is showing signs of recovery following the last patent cliff. That's according to a new Outlook report from Chicago-based Zacks Investment Research. The last few quarters have been tough, with major blockbusters such as Merck's Singulair and Pfizer's Lipitor losing patent protection. The major patent expiries are over and done with, the report reads. New products should start contributing significantly to results and increase pipeline visibility, and appropriate utilization of cash should increase confidence in the sector. Major deals cited so far in the year include British drug maker and research triangle Park Stalwart, GlaxoSmithKline's acquisition of Human Genome Sciences. The original Q Shack made something other than barbecue January 2nd. It made a difference, $10,000 worth. Owner Dan Ferguson gave 100% of the sales from his Durham restaurant on January 2 to the National Alliance for Mental Illness. The inspiration? The Newtown, Connecticut school shooting tragedy. I realize that the tragedy in Newtown could happen anywhere and that part of the problem is access, he says, referring to mental health resources. And Q Shack wasn't the only restaurant working for the cause. Employees of Bullock's Barbecue, Durham Catering Company, Only Burger, and Rise Biscuits and Donuts were on site to help. Between 750 and 800 people came out to support the cause, and $9,528.72 was raised. Ferguson made up the difference to bring the total to $10,000. NAMI, N-A-M-I, has a local office in Durham. Contactology, led by Drew Adams, is moving to a new downtown Durham headquarters, one that will accommodate its growth and expanding client base, execs say. Previously, at a facility at Holland Street Mall, the company is moving to Washington Street. The previous space had 2,200 square feet. At 4,200 square feet, the new location, owned by Zapolinsky Real Estate, will house 20 employees. In 2012, the company's server sent more than 2.1 billion email messages on behalf of clients, a 168% increase over the year prior. Del Webb, a division of Pulte Group, on January 7, broke ground on the first lots for its next active adult community, Carolina Arbors, which will rival in size its Carolina Preserve at Amberley Community in Cary. Carolina Preserve has nearly completed selling the 1,250 home sites. Carolina Arbors is expected to have 1,275 homes on about 460 acres near Briar Creek. An associate professor of forestry and natural resources at NC State University spent $3,359 from state grant funds for trips to the North Carolina Outer Banks, but could not provide documentation that showed he performed the proper work during those trips, according to a state audit. In 2009, the professor, who was not identified in the audit, applied for a grant from the North Carolina Department of Transportation to examine whether remote sensing could be used for the monitoring of submerged aquatic vegetation in the Currituck Sound of North Carolina, according to the audit. In 2011, the professor took two trips to the Outer Banks with his family, one time staying at a resort near Duck at a rate of $587.69 per night for three nights. The professor told auditors he did the appropriate work and recorded the results, but did not keep the documentation himself after turning them in to his research assistant. Auditors asked other researchers what was their standard protocol for collecting data and found that researchers typically keep all of their own data for future reference. The lack of documentation, timing of trips, and inclusion of family members raised a number of questions regarding the necessity and work-related purpose of these trips. In our opinion, without documentation supporting a business purpose, DOT grant funds should not have been used to fund the professor's travel to the Outer Banks region in the summer of 2011, the audit reads. In a response letter to auditors, NC State said it reminded all researchers of proper protocol on all research grant projects. The university also noted that the grant in question is on track to be completed successfully and to provide important understanding of our North Carolina's coastal resources. A new study shows Raleigh residents with Verizon cell phone service are ahead in data performance. Root Metrics tested each carrier network's ability to download or upload files and also judged how well customers could successfully access a carrier's data network. Verizon won the category with its LTE network, delivering an average download speed of 15.1 megabytes per second and an average upload speed of 9.7 megabytes per second. Verizon was followed by AT&T with average download and upload speeds of 12.4 megabytes per second and 6.9 megabytes per second, respectively. Novozymes, which has an enzyme plant in Franklinton, has received an award of up to $2.5 million from the U.S. Department of Energy to find new and more efficient enzymes for creating car and truck fueling corn. For creating car and truck fuel using corn. The project runs for 2 years and relies on biology to rapidly and cost-effectively screen natural enzyme diversity for the best-performing enzymes. Enzyme combinations will be tested on pre-treated agricultural waste, converted into sugars, and then into bio-based products and advanced biofuels. The Marbles Kids Museum in downtown Raleigh will, on January 12, open a new exhibit called Workout Zone, in partnership with the Carolina Hurricanes. The Hurricanes Kids and Community Foundation has provided a goal grant to the museum to help fund the exhibit that will have components where kids can play, crank, balance, climb, and train just like the Hurricanes all day long. Winston-Salem-based Data Chambers is renovating a triangle facility and turning it into a data center. Renovation started Tuesday on a 50,000-square-foot building, an 8-acre property in Garner, purchased by Data Chambers in late September. The first step, the company says, is to reinforce the building to meet Category 3 hurricane standards. Landmark Construction of Winston-Salem is serving as contractor for that phase of the project. The M&I Homes Builder Group is hosting a party on January 12, to celebrate the opening of its newest community, Woods at Umstead, located at Trenton and Reedy Creek Roads, near the entrance to Umstead State Park. The Woods at Umstead will have 26 home lots with units starting in the 480,000s. Contributing to biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Lauren Onsorge, Jason DeBrun, Ken Elkins, and Chris Bagley. And next in the Triangle Business Journal, we have a collection of stories. The headline on the collection is North Carolina's 74th Governor, Patrick Lloyd McCrory, The Beginning. And there's a few articles we'll read concerning the new governor. The first article has the headline, Consultant Picked to to fix state's broken IT. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a Dateline of Raleigh. Broken. That's the word newly sworn-in Governor Pat McCrory used to describe the state's information technology system, and he's put Charlotte businessman Chris Estes on the case as the state's new chief information officer. Estes says that in his 15 years as a consultant, he has helped guide large companies through business transformations that include large technology projects. While he couldn't be specific due to privacy agreements, he did say one of his clients was a top bank. The state of North Carolina might be more complex than a bank, however. Take an audit released January 4 by Beth Wood, state auditor. The audit examined consolidation programs instituted by the General Assembly, programs that IT services say saved the state more than $3 million. Wood says the IT staffers cannot prove the program saved any money. The crux of Wood's audit is this: since there was no system in place to monitor how divisions were improving in efficiency, it's impossible to prove anything at all regarding consolidation. She says the lack of record keeping is a big problem, particularly because the General Assembly directed that no consolidation be undertaken unless efficiency could be proven. It is surprising to me, Wood said of the audit's conclusions. You'd think they, ITS, would want to be able to go back and show the General Assembly these things. Though Wood has not spoken with McCrory directly regarding the audit, she calls McCrory's comments about problems with IT spot on and says Estes has his work cut out for him. No business can run when the different divisions or departments' computer systems won't talk to one another, she says. You just can't be successful in managing any enterprise when all the computer systems won't talk to each other. The findings are far from the end of Estes' challenges. A 2012 audit of the Department of Health and Human Services found that a Medicaid IT project could exceed cost estimates by $320 million. McCrory's statements Monday indicated the DHHS problems were prominent on his radar. Without an overhaul, we're going to have some major issues in July regarding our citizens getting the needed services from state government, he said during his first news conference as governor on January 7, referring to systemic problems that could impact whether people can get food stamps and Medicaid. So the problems are daunting, but how did McCrory come around to choosing Estes, a man he didn't know by name until a little more than a month ago, as his fix-it person? Estes explained it began when he volunteered to work on the newly elected governor's transition team. Obviously, being in Charlotte, I've had an opportunity to meet Pat at various functions in various years, but quite frankly, I don't know if Pat knew who I was when I showed up at the transition office, he says. Estes says he had no expectations and just wanted to help the transition from Beverly Perdue to McCrory. He had some Marriott travel points, he says, which allowed him a free stay in Raleigh, and decided to use free time to help the transition. Apparently, he made an impression. McCrory didn't require an interview for his decision to appoint Estes. I was here every day working 12 hours a day, Estes says, adding that recently he was called to meet with the governor. I did, and we came to an agreement to work together. One of his first acts will be discussing recent audits directly with Wood. In the meantime, he has an employee working up a summary of the audit. He took McCrory's broken comment very seriously, but says it's not the full story. He talked about a legacy of multiple administrations not giving the right attention to different systems. In this case, we're referring to technology systems, Estes says. Many of them are old and simply have to be modernized. The people being asked to maintain those systems are doing incredible work. He agrees with Wood that ITS should do a better job in record keeping, baselining where we were so we can look forward and monitor our success. While he knows there's a challenge ahead, he says he won't shy away from them. Of course, it's only his first week. The governor gave us our marching orders, and they are very clear, he says. We're going to listen and learn, and then we're going to lead. My focus is listening and learning. Departing CIO Jonathan Womer has been very helpful, he says. Womer did not respond to requests for comment. And the next article in this section has a picture of the new governor being sworn in. The caption reads, Governor Pat McCrory takes the oath of office as North Carolina's 74th governor. The headline on the next story, Great Expectations, McCrory Says What Business Leaders Want to Hear. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker. Molded in Charlotte's corporate and political climate and tested in two statewide campaigns, Pat McCrory is now stepping into his governorship with good wishes from a business community ready for change. Members of that community are taking at face value McCrory's oft repeated pledge that he'll try to improve North Carolina's business climate. They believe such change is complex and long overdue. I'd say the best word to describe how my members feel is optimistic, says Greg Thompson, North Carolina State Director of the National Federation of Independent Business. We're very confident that we'll see positive changes during his administration. The group represents 8,300 small businesses across the state. NFIB members overwhelmingly endorsed McCrory in 2008 and 2012. Of all the candidates, he was the only one who talked about helping existing small businesses, Thompson says. Incentives and recruiting new companies into North Carolina are important. Everybody knows that, but taking care of the companies that are already here is what McCrory has been talking about. First and foremost, those companies are looking for realistic enforcement of environmental regulations, Thompson says. Greg Bolin, managing director of Morgan Creek Ventures in Chapel Hill, will be looking for something else. As a technology and biotech investor, Bolin has come to believe that North Carolina, and the Triangle in particular, has been losing ground over the past 4 years to other high-tech hotspots, including Boulder, Colorado, Boston, and New York. A McCrory administration making good on its promises would help stem the perceived tide, Bolin says. I think he understands business and that you have to stay out of the way for businesses to be successful, Bolin said. I also think he understands that you have to have a friendly environment to attract anybody. I'm a fan. Born in Columbus, Ohio in 1956, Patrick Lloyd McCrory first settled in North Carolina in the Triad and later relocated to Charlotte. He there became a longtime Duke Energy executive and a Charlotte City Councilman and later mayor for 14 years. In those roles, acquaintances say he got the practical experience and developed the leadership style that will serve him well in Raleigh. He's a classic leader, says longtime McCrory friend Michael Smith, CEO of Charlotte Center City Partners, the agency that helps spark development at Charlotte's urban core. He's pro-business and he has wide experience from putting in sidewalks to handling massive transit projects. Andy Doolin, a Charlotte City Councilman who worked closely with McCrory, says the state's incoming governor is a man of vision, but more than that, a man of courage as well. Winning electoral support from all parts of the city, Doolin says, McCrory managed over time to irritate almost every group making up his constituency if he felt strongly enough about a particular issue. McCrory pushed for and won a light rail project for Charlotte and a 1/2-cent sales tax hike to help pay for it. When opponents rose up to challenge the tax in a referendum a few years later, McCrory held his ground, defeating them at the polls. If he thinks something is right, he sticks to it, Doolin says. Yet another Charlotte acquaintance said McCrory is first and foremost a consensus builder. I watched him as mayor, said Winston Kelly, executive director of Charlotte's NASCAR Hall of Fame, himself a former Duke Energy executive. Kelly has known McCrory since the late 1980s. One of the things I noticed was how he worked very hard to make sure that everyone had their say, Kelly says. Even if he didn't share their perspective, didn't matter. He was able to strike a balance, and I think you'll find that Pat is a man who knows about a broad range of subjects. After McCrory's defeat to Beverly Perdue in the 2008 gubernatorial race, it was by no means a given that McCrory would seek the office again in 2012, according to Kelly. It was his first political loss. But I did not see even a hint of bitterness, Kelly says. What McCrory did instead was take time off to consider his options. And in the end, I think he asked, what's the best thing for me? And decided to run again because he felt like he had something to offer, Kelly says. He now enters the state's highest office with the wind at his back. Raleigh-based public policy polling found in December that 53% of poll respondents had a favorable opinion of McCrory, with only 25% holding an unfavorable view. He had an 82% favorability rating with Republicans, 50% with independents, and a not-too-shabby 33% with Democrats. One of those Democrats is Jean G. Aurelian, CEO of Durham-based Symetrica. Like others in the business community, he has invested hope in the incoming administration. I think he's very pragmatic, Aurelian says, adding that he believes McCrory will make the necessary investments in infrastructure and elsewhere to bolster the state's business environment. I have a high degree of confidence in him for the impact that he will have on the economic turnaround of the state. And our next article is titled, Timeline, Who is Pat McCrory? Mayor Pat, as Pat McCrory was known for 14 years in Charlotte, became Governor Pat on January 5 in a private ceremony. In politics since 1989, McCrory has more recently begun making his mark in Raleigh, for example, by tapping ousted Wake County School Superintendent Tony Tata as his Department of Transportation chief, and naming the conservative activist and financier Art Pope as director of the State Office of Management and Budget. Not knowing what the future has in store, here's a snapshot of McCrory's past. October 17, 1956, born in Columbus, Ohio. 1974, graduates from Ragsdale High in Jamestown, North Carolina, between Greensboro and High Point. 1978, graduates from Catawba College in Salisbury. He receives a teaching certificate, but foregoes a career in education to take a job with Charlotte-based Duke Energy. McCrory tapped several former Duke colleagues last week to lead government agencies. 1988, marries Ann Gordon. 1989, McCrory is elected as an at-large Charlotte City Councilman. He is re-elected in 1991 and 93. 1993, serves as Charlotte's mayor pro tem. 1995, at age 39, McCrory becomes Charlotte's youngest ever mayor. He follows Richard Vinroot and is the Queen City's 53rd mayor. He uses the veto 22 times in 14 years as mayor. 1995, McCrory founds the Mayor's Mentoring Alliance, an effort to give local youths role models and keep them off the streets. 1998, McCrory pushes through a referendum on a half-cent sales tax dedicated to transit, particularly a light rail line that serves downtown. 2001, the arena battle. Charlotte City Council approves a bundled arena package in an attempt to keep the Charlotte Hornets in town. After the city conditions the funding on a change of ownership, owner George Shin moves the team to New Orleans. The expansion Bobcats NBA team begins using the new $265 million city-owned arena in 2005, but attendance has been disappointing at times. 2002, McCrory is nominated to the United States Homeland Security Advisory Council by President George W. Bush. 2005, Charlotte, with encouragement from Mayor McCrory, bids to become the site of the NASCAR Hall of Fame. 2006, Charlotte is selected as site of the $200 million complex. McCrory successfully pushes for an increased hotel tax to fund its construction. November 2007, Charlotte's first light rail line opens after McCrory helps organize defeat of a referendum that would have repealed a half-cent sales tax for public transportation. 2007, officially retires from Duke Energy to run for governor of North Carolina. November 2008, loses a narrow gubernatorial race to then-Lieutenant Governor Beverly Perdue. August 2009, McCrory headlines a Charlotte rally against President Barack Obama's Affordable Care Act. 2009, McCrory becomes a partner with Charlotte's sales consulting firm McCrory & Company. 2010, McCrory is named Senior Director of Strategic Initiatives at Charlotte-based law firm Moore & Van Allen. 2010, NASCAR Hall of Fame opens. After an initial flood of visitors there, some Charlotteans have been disappointed at the attendance figures and operating deficits. November 2012, beats out Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton for the governorship. January 5, 2013, McCrory was sworn in as North Carolina's first Republican governor since James Martin left office in 1993. Now we're done with that section, but as we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal, the first one is related to the governor. The headline, Transportation Woes Weigh Heavily on McCrory and Tata. And this article is written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Raleigh. Of all the pressing issues that face North Carolina in 2013 and beyond, people in the transportation field say highways and transit are squarely at the top of the list, and that Transportation Secretary Tony Tata has his work cut out for him. They cite a gamut of reports showing aging infrastructure and a funding system in the early stages of a major crisis. They also cite population growth, particularly at the edges of the triangle and the state's other metropolitan areas. Still, they cite reasons for optimism that the state government will meet the looming challenges. As mayor of Charlotte, new governor Pat McCrory developed a reputation as a strong backer of public transit and other transportation projects. And while McCrory and members of the legislature's expanded Republican majority have proposed a range of budgetary cuts, transportation hasn't been a prime target. Still, a prevalent view in the industry is that the state has been shortchanging its infrastructure for several years. Conditions on North Carolina's highways have become worse than those in all neighboring states, says Tom Crosby of AAA Carolinas. It's a collision course that nobody wants to discuss, Crosby says. Funding is the other part of that collision course, Crosby and others have said. North Carolina's Department of Transportation considers about a quarter of the bridges in Wake County and more than one-third of those in Durham and Orange counties to be structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. And consider the context. Multiple studies have found that the nation as a whole is falling behind. The World Economic Forum, a think tank headquartered in Geneva, Switzerland, ranks the U.S. 16th in terms of its infrastructure, down from 7th 4 years ago. Everyone who travels abroad knows that the U.S. no longer meets world-class infrastructure standards. William Galston, who chairs the Brookings Institution's Governance Studies Program, writes in a recent report, "We have slipped in every category, roads, ports, railroads, and most precipitously, in air transport and the quality of electric supply." One looming issue is declining revenue from the tax on motor fuels. National standards on fuel efficiency are scheduled to rise steeply over the next few years. While that's progress in some regards, it also puts NCDOT and transportation departments around the nation in a pickle because the costs of building and maintaining roads aren't likely to fall as cars consume less fuel. You really get into a math problem, says Jay Stem, executive director of the North Carolina Aggregates Association, which represents gravel and sand producers. Alternatives include increased fees for license plate renewals, expanded use of toll roads, and even a system that would charge owners based on how many miles their vehicles travel. In recent interviews, legislators and transportation advocates balked when asked to recommend one of these options over the others. Meanwhile, legislators already acted in mid-2012 to cap the fuels tax, which would otherwise rise and fall with wholesale fuel prices. North Carolinians pay 56.2 cents per gallon in state and federal taxes, the most in the southeastern U.S., in part because highway maintenance benefits from less local funding than in many other states. And now we turn to the A Better World page. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we'll read the column written by Todd Cohen. The headline on the column, "Law Would Require Insurers to Cover Costly Autism Treatments." There's also a large picture of two people standing in front of a bookcase, professionally dressed. The caption reads, "Christy White, Director of Development, and CEO Tracy Sheriff of the Autism Society of North Carolina." In the long session of the state legislature that convened January 9, a bill is expected to be introduced that would require private health insurers to cover treatment related to autism. That requirement would cover costs that can exceed $50,000 a year for some families, and on average it would add 31 cents a month to costs for all members insured by companies that offer autism coverage in the 32 other states that have passed similar legislation, says Tracy Sheriff, CEO of the Autism Society of North Carolina. The legislation, he says, is important in the face of growing growth in the prevalence of autism, which affects 1 in 88 individuals in the U.S., including more than 60,000 North Carolinians, up from 1 in 150 in 2000. Founded in 1970, the Autism Society provides advocacy, training, and education, and direct services for individuals with autism and their families. The Raleigh-based agency operates with an annual budget of $16 million, and in the fiscal year ended June 30, 2012, serve nearly 11,000 people with autism, a development disability characterized by difficulties in understanding social relationships and interactions. The Autism Society, for example, employs 18 parent advocates who work with parents of children with autism in all 100 counties in the state, providing support for children throughout their lives, and operates 49 chapters, all led by volunteers, that serve families and provide peer support in 66 counties. And it serves as an advocate on public policy issues, including the shift to managed care and the impact that will have on families living with autism. The agency also provides workshops, conferences, and consulting for individuals and families, as well as training for organizations ranging from schools, libraries, and churches to medical practices, hospitals, child care providers, and employers. It provides residential housing for 25 adults in 7 communities, as well as job training, day programming for people with autism not ready for competitive employment, and community-based services mainly for children who live at home. And it's Camp Royal in Chatham County, the oldest and largest camp in the U.S. for people with autism, served 350 adults and children last summer, and serves another 650 people during the rest of the year. The Autism Society, which generates $10.3 million in Medicaid reimbursements and $3.3 million through a state contract, raises another $1.4 million through fundraising. It recently received a 3-year, $100,000 gift from the Ireland Family Foundation in Chapel Hill to create the position of clinical director, which will be filled by Alec Myers, former director of the state's Murdoch Development Center in Butner. And with founding support from Evernham Family Racing for a Reason, it is launching a program in Davidson to serve young adults. While some autism organizations focus on medical research, the Autism Society focuses on supporting people living with the disorder, says Christy White, the agency's director of development. We are looking to improve the lives of individuals with autism, support families affected by autism, and educate our community, she says. And now the nonprofit news. Wells Fargo and Company team members have donated $588,000 to nonprofit organizations and schools throughout the Triangle and Eastern North Carolina as part of the company's annual Community Support and United Way campaign. It's a 44% year-over-year increase in donations and resulted in 1,300 volunteer hours. PNC Bank has granted $25,000 to the John Avery Boys and Girls Club in Durham to go towards efforts to increase K-3 reading performance in Durham through Project Learn, a tutoring and mentoring program aimed at increasing club members' academic performance. Junior Achievement of Eastern North Carolina has received a grant of $25,000 from Walmart Foundation. The grant funds will allow Junior Achievement to take financial literacy, entrepreneurship, and workforce readiness programs to more than 1,000 students in Eastern North Carolina through the work of trained corporate and community volunteers. And in the People on the Move section, the following were named officers on the Downtown Raleigh Alliance's 2013 Board of Directors: Jill Heath of Mulkey Engineers and Consultants, Chair; Thomas Skip Hill of Highwoods Properties, Vice Chair and Treasurer; Clymer Cease of Pierce, Brinkley, Cease and Lee, Immediate Past Chair; and Bo Dempster of Pointer Spruill, Secretary; Rodney Gaddy of Duke Energy; Sharon Moe of North State Bank; and John Wilson of Kimley Horn and Associates were named at-large members. The DRA works to manage and promote downtown Raleigh. The North Carolina Planned Giving Council named Elizabeth Ayers of Chapel Hill to its 2013 Board of Directors. NCPGC works to promote charitable giving throughout North Carolina. And now we'll read from a new section in the Triangle Business Journal. This is a section focused on technology. It's headline Technology. Lauren Onsorge explores the world of information technology and biotechnology in the Triangle. There are two articles here. The first one: Medicago hints at new jobs in Durham. Vaccine developer Medicago's latest contract means local jobs. That's according to Mike Wanner, Executive Vice President of Operations for Medicago. The U.S. Department of Defense contract isn't just good news for Medicago, it's good news for Durham, he says. In short, the contract means Medicago can now bid for Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, projects. Wanner added that the feds indicated solicitations could come as early as February, meaning there's a strong possibility the local headcount will grow. Depending on the size of the order, we would very likely need to staff up to meet the demands of it, he says. Medicago currently employs about 70 at its Durham-based vaccine plant. New hires would likely be a combination of full-time and contract positions. And the other article is headlined, Catalent Cements Local Footprint. And this article that has a dateline of Morrisville also has a picture of two men working inside of a lab wearing lab coats. The caption reads, Catalent grew by 40 employees over the past 4 months. Somerset, New Jersey-based Catalent Pharma Solutions is growing, both in headcount and capabilities, and Morrisville gets a front-row seat as the company, which grew by 40 employees locally over the past 4 months, continues to evolve. As Catalent consolidates, the Morrisville campus is an increasingly important player, the recipient of a lab when the company closed its San Diego site, and the recipient of a newly acquired technology from GlaxoSmithKline. The company, which provides pharmaceutical development, manufacturing, and packaging services on a contract basis, employs 9,000 at locations around the globe. To understand the Morrisville site, one has to venture past the lobby and into a long hallway lined with glass doors and labs. Bigger than it looks, says Christine Dolan, the company's site lead, vice president, and general manager. And it is, think 200,000 square feet of laboratory space alone, the product of multiple acquisitions and hiring sprees, and it's constantly changing. This is where the company can produce 10,000 vials per shift in a sterile environment. Each room in the factory has a camera, both for security and so that clients don't have to go through a 20-minute cloaking procedure to see their products being created. Behind the glass, air is measured as having less than 100 particles per cubic foot. On the other side of the glass, it's hundreds of thousands, Dolan says. That's part of the reason for the $3 million price tag, filters and aeration systems, but it's a price tag well worth it, Dolan says, as it increases the site's capabilities for top-name clients. Execs are saying the site will grow by 8% over the next year, partially thanks to the investment in sterile product development. In the past 4 months, the company hired 40 locally, with 35 local positions still available, but new hires aren't what gets Dolan the most excited. It's what Catalent can do and where she sees the company going. Dolan says that 49 of the top 50 pharma companies, including GSK, utilize Catalent services. The staff numbers 350. The Morrisville campus is an increasingly important one to Catalent, evidenced by the fact that Optiform Technologies, a recently acquired drug screening system developed at GSK, is now housed here, as are its scientists. It's not that much different, actually, Pingyoung Chen, Solid State Manager and GSK Transplant, says. We now have more clients than just GSK. The Morrisville site serves one unit, the Development and Clinical Services Business Unit at Catalent. Specifically, it serves the Development and Analytical Solutions subunit, a unit that was recently doubled to 900 employees globally, due to Catalent's acquisition of Kansas City, Missouri-based Aptuit's clinical trial supplies business. And with our remaining minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Could Cubist be targeting Sempra for an acquisition? Could Sempra Pharmaceuticals be an acquisition target? Lexington, Massachusetts-based Cubist Pharmaceuticals, which makes products to treat bacterial infections in hospitals, is trying to reach $2 billion in annual revenue by 2017, a goal analysts say it can't make without an acquisition, and Sempra could be a target. Cubist has $897 million in cash and a lot of options. The company could, Bloomberg News reports, go after Optimer Pharmaceuticals Incorporated or Cadence Pharmaceuticals. Another option, to go after smaller targets, such as Sempra. Vacuum bag plant in Oxford shuts down, lays off 35. What's left of a vacuum bag and filter production plant in Granville County that is owned by Home Care Industries Incorporated has been shut down, putting 35 employees out of work. Clifton, New Jersey-based Home Care Industries notified the North Carolina Department of Commerce that it shut down the plant on West Street in Oxford on January 2nd. A company official stated in a letter sent to Oxford Mayor Jacqueline Sargent and the Commerce Department's Workforce Development Team on January 2nd that Home Care Industries had been trying to secure capital from a new investor or lender. "We believe there was a realistic opportunity to raise enough capital to maintain the company's business operations and to avoid the termination of its employees," wrote Christine Watson, vice president for human resources at the company's plant in La Crosse, Virginia. New York's Ketchum to acquire Raleigh's Capstrat. New York-based public relations and communications company Ketchum is acquiring Capstrat, which will continue to operate under the same name and expand staff. Financial details of the transaction were not disclosed. "They won't let me talk about that," says Ken Udy, Capstrat CEO and co-founder of the Raleigh-based company, "but it is good." Based on the industry average of an acquisition price of 5 to 6 times earnings, the deal could be valued at more than $20 million. Salix stock struggles to gain traction. It has been a rough few months for Salix Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, but Raleigh's homegrown company got some good news when the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved one of its drugs late last year. Still, it seems investors are only slowly warming up to what Salix can accomplish with the new drug, which will treat diarrhea in patients with HIV and AIDS. Watchdog group appealing Duke merger approval. An environmental watchdog group on Wednesday gave notice that it will appeal the approval, which regulators gave in June, of Duke Energy's merger with Progress Energy. The notice came in a filing that the North Carolina Waste Awareness and Reduction Network said it made to the North Carolina Court of Appeals. The North Carolina Utility Commission approved the merger in June. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can reach us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.